not going to lie, I always welcome an opportunity to get a little goddess energy into this room. So one day this week, I went out into my backyard and I discovered that there was an invasion underway. The invaders came armed and they had gained a lot of ground when I wasn't looking. You see, last summer I noticed this thistle growing in a corner of my yard. One of those big invasive ones that are nearly as tall as I am and are covered every inch of leaf and stem with spikes like an inch or two long. You know the ones I'm talking about? I know those spikes. They'll go right through my gloves, even the heavy leather ones for pruning roses. It was going to be a beast to remove, and probably painful. And I wasn't really suited up for it right then, so I told myself I'd come back out for it in a day or two. But it was summertime, and we were traveling to see family for a couple of weeks, and then we went to Plug Pond a lot, and we had some projects we were working on in the house, a few things we did in the driveway, but I didn't spend a lot of time in my backyard. And the thistle, tucked into a corner out of sight from my windows, faded from my mind. But it did not fade from the backyard. Do you ever have things like this? Tasks that you know are important, activities you really genuinely want to do more of, causes you truly value, but they're outside the flow of your day-to-day life, and they tend to just kind of slip from mind? I know I have. I have a bunch of those. Well, this particular lapse, small as it seems in the grand scheme of things, has resulted in dozens of baby spike monsters sprouting all over my back lawn. One thorny problem, now multiplied many times over, because it was mostly out of my sight. So despite what I said a minute ago, I'm not a person who uses the word God or goddess very often. I'm not a theist in the traditional sense. Even the idea of God as love, as many use it, never quite fit for me. A little too soft, not quite raw enough. But the goddess, the way Starhawk describes it in the Earth Path, that is something different. The goddess as the name that we put on the great process of birth, growth, death and regeneration that underlie the living world. The face and voice that people gave to the way the land spoke to them. That, to me, is as close to the heart of the sacred as anything I have ever heard put into words. The living whole of the earth and all its creatures interwoven. And I do love the neo-pagan holidays and traditions, the rituals. I love the wheel of the year that marks the darkness of winter solstice, the first fruits of spring, the first bread from the New Year's wheat crop in the summer, the full harvest in the fall. But if I am completely honest, I love these things almost more symbolically than truly. It feels, in a way, almost a little quaint, hearkening back to those times in days of yore when people actually noticed the state of the harvest. Reverence given for good fortune, for things that I largely take for granted. I notice the darkness of the winter months mostly as a curiosity, safe indoors with my electric lights. I cannot tell last year's flower from this year's, and my access to bread never wavers with the seasons. Indeed, I have, most years, absolutely no idea how this year's harvest went relative to other years. Unless you are a farmer or an avid gardener, and I know there are some of you, but unless you are, I'm guessing you have a similar experience. As a society, we have created this far-flung food web so big we can't see the edges of it almost. Hauling produce thousands of miles to supply urban centers, far from temperate growing centers. The result is something that our ancestors would have found miraculous. Oranges in Massachusetts in January, fresh apples in April, spices like cinnamon from the other side of the world sitting there easy on the shelf, and they're not even very expensive. If we have the funds, and for many in our communities that is a big if, we can get just about any food we want, anytime. And it's not just food, of course. We are comfortable beyond our ancestors' dreams. If we are housed, we have dry shelter full of life, full of light at any hour. Clean water from the tap all year round, even in a drought. Many of us can keep our homes as warm or as cool as we wish, regardless of the season. There are reasons we want these things. I don't ever mean to minimize this. Comfort feels like a nicety, but truly, people who have access to all these things survive. They survive calamities in ways that people who do not have access don't necessarily. This stability is survival. The drive for comfort is powerful. But it does come with a cost. Unless we are farmers, we may hardly notice the timing of the frosts, the heights of the summer heat, or the lack of it. Sorry, the rain, or the lack of it, as much more than inconveniences. Even a bad year for a crop might only register as a higher price at the store. It would have to get really, really bad before we felt it, personally, immediately. Our comfort comes precisely from being insulated from the ups and downs of the natural world. The distance is intrinsic to the stability. This is what I call the comfort paradox. The very system that keeps us comfortable also disconnects us from the source of our comfort. But of course, the dependence on the natural world is still there, as real and visceral as it ever was. We just don't feel it directly from day to day. As a side note, this doesn't only apply to our physical comfort. It's also true of social comfort. If you've ever lived with many roommates or in dense apartment buildings, you know that soon you know everyone's business and everyone knows yours. But many of us, especially those with privilege, now regularly share our living spaces only with those closest to us in our families. And the more financially comfortable we grow, the more physically distance we often are from our neighbors. This brings the pleasures of quiet and privacy, the abilities to set up our homes just as we wish without fraught negotiations. But the cost is that we may never see people unless we go out of our way to seek them out, and our neighbors could be in crisis and we would never know. I've seen that happen. It can be lonely and disconnected for all its comfort. And that's part of why we come here, right? To see one another. And I know it's still uncomfortable at times. I bet there are some of you who dread the greeting time at the beginning. Yes, I know you're out there. You're not going to raise your hands, though, because you're those people. Or the coffee hour at the end, or even the candle time in the middle. I hear you. It's awkward. The greeting, so what do I say to this person? I don't know this person. Are we waving? Or no, we're shaking hands. Was that enough? Do I have to say something more, or do I turn to the next? It's a tough moment. I feel you. But as is so often true, the alternative to that discomfort is disconnection. We have to weather the awkwardness of those occasional interactions, the occasional discomforts, too, of one another's foibles, if we ever want to bridge the distance. Because humans do need community, even if we sometimes kind of would rather not. Why does it matter, though, ultimately, this disconnection? In the big picture, because we give our time and our energy to the things we connect to. Just take one of my favorite recent Forbes headlines. Rich people donate more when they actually see poor people, study suggests. It has long been noted that the very wealthy tend to donate their wealth primarily to cultural institutions like the opera or museums that are frequently patronized by the wealthy. Sometimes this gets derided as a sign of narcissism, but honestly, I think it's something simpler. These are the places they go, the things they connect to. They see a need right in front of them because no cultural institution is ever really wealthy. They see a need and they answer it. But the vast comfort of the very wealthy also comes with vast disconnection. And many months may go by for them without ever really seeing and interacting with people who are genuinely needy. One study I found years ago found that simply asking multimillionaires to spend time regularly in the same spaces as people who are struggling, with no further expectation, just that they would go there and be there for a little while, led to a surge in giving to the kinds of charities that directly assist people in need. We give our time and our energy to the things we connect to. But comfort comes from disconnection. And so I circle back to that goddess, to that beautiful interconnected web of life that is our world, because she is struggling too. I've spoken here before about climate change. I won't rehash it all now. But I hope that you know in your soul that our Earth is profoundly and immediately in need of our assistance. But it's difficult to get people really riled up about it and sustain that, to get really riled up about a catastrophe in slow motion, one that unfolds over decades. And I think it's especially hard when we're so comfortable. Mostly we don't feel the changes in our day-to-day lives. And so when we're choosing where to give our energy, where to give our time, and our funds. This crisis rarely feels like the most pressing, the most immediate to us personally, even if it is the biggest one of all. So what do we do? In the Earth Path, Starhawk suggests that the first step is to reconnect with nature. She describes a full practice of mindfulness meditation taken in nature with your eyes open and sometimes your feet in motion. Finding a place close to you that is at least a little natural, your yard if you have one, a park nearby, a vacant lot, and going there regularly. It doesn't have to be for a long time. A few minutes of sitting or standing and observing so that you begin to connect, to see the changes, to hear the creatures, to get to know it as a kind of being, that web. She suggests doing it at all seasons, and I will be perfectly honest, I have struggled to keep this practice because it's cold or wet or hot or full of bugs out there. It's not comfortable, not all the time. But it is a way of connecting, choosing to weather the discomfort, to make connection. So I ask you, is there something in your life that you want to feel more connected to? Something you want to feel closer to or more concerned about than you honestly do? And are there ways that you can shift the movement of your life to shorten the distance a little? So that in the natural flow of things, you'll feel the bumps. You'll feel the ways things change and find yourself relating, even in little moments. Whether that's a person in your life, a community that you want to be a part of, or the natural world under your feet. This is another part of church, of what church is for. It's an opportunity to pause and reflect and choose to change a little how our path is going. So I invite you to take a moment, if you can, to think of one thing that you've been wishing you did more. Is there a way that you can tighten the connection? Just a little way. Even if it makes you a little uncomfortable. You don't have to force yourself into a big gesture. Honestly, the most sustainable changes aren't like that anyway. Just find small ways to put what you care about most in your way. Go out into the yard and just look for 5 minutes. There might be a thistle out there, just saying. And if it's a little uncomfortable, greet the discomfort as a friend, knowing that it is a sign that you're bridging the distance. Start with connection. The rest flows from there.